From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Over the years, the name Cousteau has become synonymous with underwater exploration and caring for the world's oceans. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet Jean-Michel Cousteau. He and his father Jacques recently returned from a voyage to Papua New Guinea. Also today, Tony La Russa, manager of the Oakland A's and one of the winningest managers in baseball, tells us what he does when he loses. Rock critic Ken Tucker checks out new albums from Linda Ronstadt and Kate Bush. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews Billy Crystal's new HBO comedy special. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. President Bush joined Latin American leaders today for talks about drug trafficking, foreign debt, and political strife. Even before the president's arrival for a two-day celebration of Costa Rica's 100 years of democracy, Mr. Bush was being criticized by some Central American leaders. Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega has expressed his displeasure at President Bush's refusal to meet with him during the summit of leaders. In Beirut today, American Terry Anderson woke up to his fifth birthday spent in captivity. The 42-year-old bureau chief for the Associated Press was taken hostage in 1985 by Shiite fundamentalists who demanded the release of terrorists in Kuwaiti jails. Mike Theodula reports from Nicosia, Cyprus, that this birthday, like the past four, was a sad one for Anderson and his family.
The voice of four-year-old Salome Anderson, the daughter Terry's never met. Her message is on a video recording due to be broadcast on Lebanese television tonight. He'll see it if his kidnappers show a little mercy. Not that Terry Anderson's seen much kindness in the last 5.5 years. If the accounts of other hostages since freed are anything to go by, he spent much of that time in dungeon-like conditions, blindfolded and chained to a wall. There's also no indication Terry Anderson, or indeed any of the other hostages, will soon be freed. But a flood of goodwill messages from friends and relatives published in Lebanese newspapers this morning shows he's not been forgotten. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
The White House said today that President Bush will soon tell Congress he will inform it of any covert operations within a few days of such actions. Congress had wanted to be told within 48 hours of secret operations. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the letter will formalize a procedure that Mr. Bush had already been practicing. President Bush today vetoed Washington, D.C.'s budget for next year because it allowed the city to finance Medicaid abortions. In vetoing the district's budget, the president appears to be pitting one White House priority against another. Jessica Berman, a member station WAMU, reports.
The president turned thumbs down on the congressionally approved spending plan because it would have allowed D.C. to spend its own money to finance abortions for poor women in cases of rape and incest. And Bush opposes all abortions except where the mother's life is in danger. The president's veto came despite pleas by city officials that the action imperils Washington's anti-crime effort. The measure Bush vetoed also contained $32 million in federal assistance for the hiring of an additional 700 police officers to fight the drug problem. A congressional lobbyist for the city says D.C. will now be forced to borrow about $200 million in short-term loans to keep the city running. For National Public Radio, I'm Jessica Berman in Washington.
Samuel Pierce, who headed the Department of Housing and Urban Development during the Reagan administration, refused to testify before a congressional subcommittee today. This is National Public Radio News in Washington. The government said today that the U.S. budget deficit shrank by only $3.1 billion in the 1989 fiscal year. The Treasury Department said the deficit declined to $152 billion in the fiscal year, which ended September 30th. Budget Director Richard Darman says he's not satisfied with the progress made and called on Congress to show more budget discipline. Under Graham Rudman, deficit-cutting targets, the U.S. budget gap must come down to $110 billion in fiscal 1989, but some economists think it's doubtful that will happen. Early this morning, the city of Los Angeles opened the first of seven controversial hiring sites for documented and undocumented day laborers. Nancy Clark reports.
Over 150 day laborers from city street corners were loaded onto buses and brought to the city's new hiring site in the Harbor District. They were greeted by smiling city, police, and community officials, offering them toilets, phones, and bilingual staff assistance. The city is hoping to encourage the day laborers to use the city-sanctioned sites. Jesus is a day laborer from El Salvador.
It's a good idea. Everybody needs a job and miners, you know. So we feel happy. They're going to help us.
But the new Western Regional Commissioner for the INS says the city is helping illegals find work in violation of the 1986 immigration law. While he says the INS won't raid the centers looking for undocumented workers now, he can't guarantee there won't be raids in the future. For National Public Radio, I'm Nancy Clark in Los Angeles.
The State Department today said the Soviet Union is continuing its efforts to discredit and slander the U.S., despite a promise by Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev to halt disinformation. Disinformation is an effort to place false stories in newspapers and other sources of news. The State Department report, which was released 2 months later than expected, said the Soviets have continued a campaign to discredit America with reports that U.S. scientists created and spread the AIDS virus. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jean-Michel Cousteau virtually grew up exploring the oceans while living aboard his father Jacques Cousteau's research vessel, the Calypso. Jacques Cousteau was the preeminent pioneer of underwater exploration. He co-invented the original scuba diving equipment and underwater submersibles and has produced more than 100 films and TV shows about his journeys. Jean-Michel Cousteau continued the family tradition. He's a founding director of the Cousteau Society and is currently the executive producer of the TV series Cousteau's Rediscovery of the World, which is being produced for Turner Broadcasting. He also writes a newspaper column on the environment that's published by the Los Angeles Times Syndicate. Jean-Michel Cousteau led a recent expedition to Papua New Guinea. The Rediscovery TV series will feature a 3-hour special on the trip in January. It has also been documented in a new book of text and photographs published by Abrams. I asked Jean-Michel Cousteau why he wanted to go to Papua New Guinea.
We started in 73 going out there almost by accident, and I really got to like that part of the world, pretty much untouched, pretty much unexplored, and definitely not in the minds of anybody. I found an extremely rich culture. I found an extremely rich fauna and flora when it comes to the land as well as underwater. And being a water person, I got to explore extensively some of the offshore islands of Papua New Guinea and kept going back there for 5 years with groups of people, students of mine, participants, people who had a keen interest in discovering another part of the world. And the reward there was that for once I could take my father to a place where he had never been before. For 50 years he took me to the places he knew, and there I could take him to a place he had no knowledge of, and I held his hand and showed him underwater and above water what it's like, and that was quite a reward for me.
One of the highlights of your trip to New Guinea was diving and finding orca whales that were on a hunt. Why is it so rare to find that?
Well, first of all, to be able to swim in the open water with clear water is very unusual. You can find orcas, for example, in Canada or even the United States, and usually the water is not very clear. The fact that they also accept to stay with you is very unusual. We were able to jump in the water and stay with these orcas for 9 hours nonstop around one of the little islands in New Guinea. And not only were they there, there were two of them permanently, and the third one came and left, but we witnessed something which had never been seen before, never recorded before, and we were able not only to take pictures but to film it. And that was orcas feeding. They would disappear in the dark blue and come back with an entire 8 or 9 foot shark in their jaws. And they would literally play with it just like a cat would play with a mouse, and ultimately tear it apart and eat it. And we witnessed all of that. The very fact that we saw predator number one feeding on predator number two was an unbelievable sight, and it was of, I guess, great scientific significance because it allowed us not only to record it, but to pass it on to the scientists specialized in marine mammals and the orca in particular.
Did anything surprise you about the way the whales attacked and ate the shark?
That didn't surprise us because we knew they feed on big things. They occasionally, like a pack of wolf, would attack a small whale and eat it. They've been seen doing that. But to see them go and get sharks was very surprising. What surprised me the most, though, is that they would do it in front of us. You know, there's no record of orcas having attacked a human being in the wild. It has happened in captivity, but never in the wild. But looking at them doing this right in front of us made one think a little bit.
How big is an orca whale?
20 to 25 feet easily.
So when you're down there filming, do you have to use a lot of underwater lights to get a good picture?
Depends on the conditions. In the case of the orcas, we had no lighting, no artificial lights. We use available light. We are in the open water. There is no background except that deep blue, which the ocean is when it's good conditions. We use a lot of lights. On the other hand, when we film a close-up subject on the reef or something happening, a large school of fish or a kelp bed, for example, here in California, and we often have to shut off our lights in certain circumstances because it scares off the animals.
Mm-hmm.
So we use the lights every time we can because it restores the real colors and the water, which you don't see otherwise. But sometimes we cannot do it.
So the orca whales didn't attack you. Has a sea creature ever attacked you? Did you ever wrestle a sea creature in the tradition of all the underwater movies? Does this happen in real life for divers?
No. We've been bothered by sharks many times in different circumstances, different areas. Sharks have a very bad reputation, and fortunately, most people don't realize that there are more than 250 species of sharks. Most of them are totally harmless. Very few, and I'll say less than 10 species, would potentially represent a problem if the conditions for the problems to take place were put together. And that means blood in the water, whether it's another animal or yourself, a certain sign of panic, like you would make it sense to a dog when you're scared, which would allow that animal to run after you. Most accidents which have taken place are due to someone being spearfishing, for example, and then you have a shark coming to get the prey, to get the fish. But if you're in the way, you may get in trouble. A lot of accidents have taken place by sharks attacking people by mistake, taking them for something else, taking them for maybe a seal or taking them for an animal. And then they realize their mistake, but it's too late. You've been hurt, and perhaps you may end up bleeding to death. So these things are happening. Very few, though. I mean, there are many fewer people that died from shark attacks than people died from bee stings. But that's, not as spectacular.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Jean-Michel Cousteau, who is a founding director of the Cousteau Society. His father is Jacques Cousteau. And Jean-Michel Cousteau is the co-author of a new book on his expedition to Papua New Guinea. You've been diving just about all your life. How has ocean pollution affected what you see when you're underwater now? And I know this changes from region to region, but I'm sure you see the difference underwater from, compared to what it was like when you started.
Well, I've seen changes in Southern California, for example. I've seen my own backyard in south of France being depleted to the point and polluted to the point where I don't go back there diving anymore, and I cannot show my own kids what I used to see when I was their age. It's impossible for me to go out and point out things and share. It's all of memories. And that's unfair. It's unfair to the kids, unfair to the generations to come. We have to cease to look at the ocean as a universal sewer in which you can dump everything, thinking that out of sight, out of mind.
In the south of France, where you grew up, where you used to dive and where you dive no longer, compare what it looked like then to what it looks like now.
I remember very clear waters. I remember an abundance of marine life. When you go back today, the water is turbid. The ocean floor is covered with foreign objects, whether it's cans or plastic, which are absorbed by a lot of species of animals and kill them by internal infections. Many of the species of fish that we used to find on the market sold by the fishermen are now gone. And the ones that we didn't take in those days because they were looked upon or considered as second rate or no good to eat are the ones you find on the market today. And so because we've eliminated the good stuff, now we're going for something which is not necessarily as good. And I'm talking about taste, not necessarily the value of the proteins, which I'm sure they still have at least as good as the others.
You've been to Alaska to the site of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. You have some suggestions for how to prevent future oil spills, and I'd like you to share some of those.
Yes, we went up to the Valdez, Exxon Valdez and Prince William Sound area 6 times so far. We're going to go back this winter. We're producing a one-hour special on the issue, and we're going to suggest all kinds of solutions to the problems that we faced with. From a human aspect, based on the fact that a man alone is in bad company, we feel that you should have, in sensitive areas, 2 people in charge of skipping the boat. So you need 2 skippers for that period of time. We suggest also that vessels should be the size of what the cleanup technology can afford in that particular area. So we will probably have to deal with smaller size vessels for the time being, and maybe they can grow as the technology and the equipment grows. We suggest that there be a double hull system, and there are different systems. I will not go into that, but double hull is necessary. We strongly recommend 2 engines and 2 propellers so a ship can turn much faster, which is not the case with most tankers these days. We strongly recommend, and this is probably very easy to implement, that we have in all those sensitive areas exactly what we have with our airlines, with our aviation system. We need to do the very, very same thing with vessels, not just tankers, any vessels, in those sensitive areas, and we have to have ocean controllers.
Like air traffic controllers.
Exactly. And if you have ocean controllers or traffic controllers, ocean traffic controllers, and you dispatch them wherever they have to be all around the country of the United States, it's going to cost you much less than the cleanup of one accident, such as the Exxon Valdez. For that kind of money, my God, we can equip the entire country overnight.
My guest is ocean explorer Jean-Michel Cousteau. He's a founding director of the Cousteau Society, leads ocean expeditions, writes articles about the environment for the LA Times Syndicate. He also has a new book that documents his recent trip to Papua New Guinea. And he's producing a TV program about the trip for the series Cousteau's Rediscovery of the World, which is on Turner Broadcasting. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Jean-Michel Cousteau is my guest. Your father is Jacques Cousteau, and you grew up largely on his ship, the Calypso. The ship was a World War II minesweeper. How did your family get it?
Well, my father was in the Navy and was very interested about what was going under the keel of his ships. During his private time, weekends and holidays and vacations, he would explore, manufacture equipment, and so on. And in 1950, he decided to take a leave of absence from the French Navy. Calypso, which was at the time a retired minesweeper, which was built in Seattle, Washington in 1942. And that ship, which had been manufactured for the British Navy, was then decommissioned on the island of Malta in the Mediterranean Sea, and she was being a ferry. And as a ferry boat, you know, not a very glorious career, that gentleman gave Calypso, which was already named Calypso, by the way, to my dad in 1950. We were not at lib to give his name away up to now, only after his death. Unfortunately, he died last year, and now we can say that it was Noel Guinness, a British gentleman from England, who took advantage of his fortune to allow my father to start with the ship Calypso.
Was the Calypso your home when you were a child?
Very much so. We, from that point on, from 50 on, we used to spend all of our holidays and vacations on board, whether it was Christmas, Easter, and mostly, of course, the summer. So we spent 3 to 4 months a year on the ship as we grew up. My mother looked at my brother and myself in those days, and she had a suitcase in her hand and said, "Kids, you're on your own." And she moved on board and has been on board Calypso ever since. When we were in the Amazon in 82, 83, she spent 10 months on the ship without spending a night ashore.
Well, so, how did you feel when she told you that you're on your own?
That was great. You know, kids always want to get away from the parents. So
the parents came away from the kids.
and them away from the kids. So we went to boarding school, and the time with the family became quality time. And that was wonderful.
Did your father teach you to swim?
Kind of. I think I was scuba diving before I knew how to swim. It was mostly going under rather than staying on the surface.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever scared when you were young and scuba diving? And
I should
mention
remember.
That your father invented the equipment that you used, right, to scuba dive?
Yeah, he co-invented with an engineer, Emile Gagnon, the regulator, which is part of the scuba equipment and allows you to breathe compressed air or compressed gas at the ambient pressure without getting into major diving accidents. And that was a breakthrough which put the equipment into the public.
Mm-hmm.
So no, I never got scared. I have some great memories of great times with both my parents and my brother. And we, as a family, we were pretty much systematically exploring the French Riviera for hundreds of miles. I didn't know any better. I didn't know other kids didn't do that. I thought it was a normal family affair, just like you go skiing. And it's only later on that I realized that I was growing alongside a pioneer, because not only was that part of his life the beginning of a discovery, but he kept inventing things all the time, and that was due to his motivation of discovering more, going deeper, staying longer, and every time he couldn't find the equipment on the shelves or existing somewhere, he would make it himself, and together with, of course, a bunch of associates, mostly engineers.
How has the diving equipment changed since you were a child and started to dive?
Not much. It's smaller, it's more streamlined, it looks better, but the fundamental principles of diving have not changed that much.
And what about the film equipment? How has film equipment changed since your family started filming underwater?
Well, film equipment has not changed that much. What has changed is the emulsions, the quality of the film itself. We're still using emulsion film. We're not yet into video at this point. We don't feel that the quality of video, particularly underwater, represent the real quality and sensitivity of what's there.
Your brother, Philippe, died in a plane crash. I was wondering if that changed the way you saw your role in the family and in the Cousteau Society.
Well, very much so. My brother was the star. He was the cameraman, and he was the star in front of the camera. And I had to fill that role, too, which was really not my cup of tea. I'm not attracted by the stardom aspect, but because of the confidence which was given to the Cousteau Society by our members throughout the world, we felt, and I felt very deeply, that I had to fill that role, because the show goes on. We don't stop, and will never stop.
Mm-hmm. Jean-Michel Cousteau is my guest. Can I ask you to describe the worst diving experience you ever had?
I think I keep that question has been asked before. I keep coming back to the same experience. I was once in a cave, and I realized I was running out of air. We were about 75 feet deep and 150 feet into the cave. And I went to turn my air reserve on, which was a natural process in those days, and realized that my air reserve was already on, so I had no air at all. And what had happened is that as I was making my way into the cave, I banged on the ceiling of the cave several times and probably turned my air reserve on by accident and did not realize it. So I was out of air, and there was absolutely no way I could swim 150 feet horizontally and then 75 feet up and make it. So all the things you learn when you learn to dive came back in a fraction of a second. And I realized that the first thing I had to do was to get to my buddy. And he was there, not very far, and we instantly started buddy breathing, and we made our way out that way. But there is that fraction of a second, which seems to be hours, during which you say, well, that's it, I've had it. And that was very unpleasant.
Do you always dive with somebody?
That's an absolute rule. People who do go diving, and I have some friends who do it, who do go diving alone are fools. They're crazy. They put very little value on life. And the absolute rule is to always dive with somebody. Always.
Does your father still dive?
My father is unbelievable. Last year, I took him diving in Papua New Guinea, and that's featured in the book, in the films as well. And he was feeling not very comfortable there. He was kind of unhappy. He came out of the water. We came out of the water. And as he was recovering, he was 78, he's now 79. As he was kind of recovering and downing his equipment, he said, you know, I'm getting old. And I felt he was depressed, and I didn't want to hear him say, I'm going to quit. But not at all. About 5 minutes later, as he felt bad, he said, you know, I'm going to design equipment for old people. And that's what he did. And that meant to readapt some of his equipment and put the regulator, double hose regulator, right on his chest, which physiologically makes it a lot easier for him to breathe, in essence. And he's been, this year, he's been back in Indonesia, diving like a fish. We couldn't keep him out of the water. And he was even holding a camera underwater and filming himself. So at 79, he's just like a young kid. He's driving me up the wall.
Okay. I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
You're very welcome. I enjoy this very much.
Jean-Michel Cousteau has been my guest. There will be a two-part special on his trip to Papua New Guinea on the series Cousteau's Rediscovery of the World on Turner Broadcasting in January. He also has a new book documenting the journey in text and photographs. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be singer Mavis Staples. For years, she sang gospel with her family, the Staple Singers. She now also sings rhythm and blues, and her latest album, Time Waits for No One, was produced by Prince. I hope you can join us.
Coming down with a sudden migraine, and here it is almost 3. Next door they're fighting again. Somebody's done somebody wrong, and some freak keeps calling up, want a quickie on the telephone. You try and try to close your eyes at night, but all you do is talk.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As his career as a baseball player was coming to an end, Tony La Russa was all set to start a second career as a lawyer. But then he thought he'd try his hand at managing. We may never know how La Russa would have done in the courtroom, but as a manager, he's led his Oakland A's to the World Series 2 years in a row. Coming up, we talk with Tony La Russa. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums from singers Linda Ronstadt and Kate Bush. Ken says Ronstadt returns to a pop rock sound, while Bush remains loopy. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone takes a look at the new Billy Crystal comedy special, Midnight Train to Moscow. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Members of a congressional panel investigating abuses at the Department of Housing and Urban Development are now calling for a special prosecutor to look into possible criminal wrongdoing by former Secretary Samuel Pierce. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Today, as expected, Samuel Pierce invoked his Fifth Amendment right not to testify before a congressional panel. After the hearing, two members of the panel said they would begin formal proceedings to get a special prosecutor appointed to continue the investigation. Representatives Chuck Schumer and Bruce Morrison say they will try to get a majority of Democrats on the Judiciary Committee to ask the Attorney General to begin an investigation to see if a special prosecutor is warranted. Pierce's attorneys maintain that the committee has yet to turn up any evidence of criminal wrongdoing or illegal acts on Pierce's part. But members of the panel say defrauding the government and perjury are possible charges. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
President Bush and President Ortega of Nicaragua shook hands today at the opening of a summit of the Americas, but spoke only briefly with each other. The meeting of leaders of the Western Hemisphere is to help celebrate 100 years of democracy in Costa Rica. Before leaving Washington, the president vetoed a money bill for Washington, D.C., that would have allowed local funds to be used to pay for abortions. East Germany today declared an amnesty for all people who have fled the country illegally and who've taken part in peaceful street demonstrations. As Deidre Berger reports from Cologne, the amnesty also covers people in prison who were caught trying to escape the country.
The amnesty covers prisoners convicted of attempted flight, which is a criminal offense in East Germany. The East German government also said that tens of thousands of East Germans who escaped to the West without valid exit visas the past few months would not be subject to criminal charges. This means the former East Germans can apply to visit family and friends in East Germany without the fear of being arrested upon re-entering the country. Currently, few of the East Germans are allowed back for visits. The East Berlin government also said the amnesty extends to those who were arrested during political demonstrations. The arrests have been a point of contention between the Communist Party and the opposition the past 2 weeks. Bärbel Bolli from the opposition New Forum said the amnesty is a first step in the right direction. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Cologne.
The Associated Press is reporting that a source close to Nicaraguan President Ortega says the Sandinista leader has decided to end a ceasefire with U.S.-supported Contra rebels. The source says Ortega will announce this decision shortly because the rebels have stepped up attacks in the north and central part of the country. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down 17 points to close at 2,596.72 on volume of some 171 million shares. Trading was active. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Pop star Linda Ronstadt and English singer-songwriter Kate Bush have new albums out. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of both, starting with Linda Ronstadt's new record.
Well, I wake up in the night now, and don't you know I think of you? It's the fire.
It's getting so it's hard to figure out what to review here these days. I can't recall a season in which there's been so much good rock music. There's solid new work by old pros like Bob Dylan, Neil Young, Jeff Beck, Ricky Lee Jones, and even Linda Ronstadt, and pleasant surprises by cult acts like Kate Bush, NRBQ, and Squeeze, and impressive debuts by Lenny Kravitz, Jane Young, and the rapper Young MC. The richness of this past month has been amazing and exhilarating. Thank goodness Billy Joel has come out with a perfectly dreadful new album, or I'd think I was hallucinating. Avoid his hokey, insufferable storm warning at all costs. Two new albums that I like a lot are by Linda Ronstadt and Kate Bush. In the case of Ronstadt, her new record, the awkwardly titled Cry Like a Rainstorm, Howl Like the Wind, arrives after a half decade spent experimenting with big band jazz, country, and Mexican folk music. This new one returns her to the pop rock that made her famous, but with some noticeable changes in her attack.
I am calling like the echo of a passing train that cries one last time before it fades into the distant hills and dies. I am sending out a message like a ship out on the sea in distress.
That's Linda Ronstadt belting out a Jimmy Webb song, Still Within the Sound of My Voice. You may have noticed the lushness of Ronstadt's instrumental backing there. On most of the songs on this album, she's supported by a full orchestra. Ronstadt and producer Peter Asher recorded this album on the soundstage of Skywalker Ranch, which is owned and operated by her current beau, George Lucas. This album is a very odd mixture, lush arrangements on the one hand, but also a series of passionate duets with the great Aaron Neville of the Neville Brothers.
Look at this man, so blessed with inspiration. Look at this soul, still searching for salvation.
I don't know much, but I know I love you. And that may be all I need to know.
There's a lot about this Ronstadt album that's terribly overwrought. She's become the most self-conscious, most ponderously technical singer in pop music, but there are also immensely enjoyable moments like that one, which are scattered throughout the album. I'd like to contrast the chilly, undeniable proficiency of Linda Ronstadt with the lulling loopiness of Kate Bush. Her eccentricity has deepened and matured on her new release called The Sensual World. Kate Bush began the decade an overnight sensation in her native England with songs with titles like Wuthering Heights. They were big, overblown, romantic thingamajigs that triumphed over Bush's pretensions and her willfully naive sentimentality. The great thing about her is that 10 years later, she's as wacky as ever. It's always been easy to take pot shots at Kate Bush, who pushes her music well past the boundaries of rock and roll and over the edge as a matter of course. One of the few critics who appreciated her early on wasn't a rock critic at all, but the London-based literary critic Clive James. During his stint as a TV critic for The Observer, James described a television performance by Bush as follows. For her opening number, she appeared in a luminous leotard with Superman trunks, a hairstyle like an exploding armchair, and bare feet. Thus got up, she groped around in the gloom, perhaps looking for her band, who were making a hell of a racket somewhere in the background. At this point, I went away for a little lie down. When I came back, she was dressed as a white hunter and pointing a rifle at the cameraman. Can there be any doubt that any performer who inspires such a description is well worth hearing?
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
This is Fresh Air. World Series resumes tonight in San Francisco, and we have an interview with the manager of the team that's ahead 2-0. Some of you hear Fresh Air tape delayed, so the series might be over by the time you hear this. Tony La Russa is the manager of the Oakland A's. He's been voted Manager of the Year twice by the Baseball Writers Association of America. During his playing career, La Russa was a utility infielder. He became the manager of the Chicago White Sox in 1979, was dismissed in July of 1986, and signed with the A's just a few days later. This is an excerpt of an interview I recorded with La Russa last May when Fresh Air visited San Francisco. The A's were tied for first place then, but I asked La Russa what he says to the team just after they lose a game.
Well, it's a tricky thing. Talking to your players is tricky in the sense that if you have a formal meeting after every ball game that you lose, then you're going to wear out the effect of you meeting with the team.
Uh-huh.
Because you play for 6 months, 162 games, and if you have a great year and you win 100 games, you're going to lose 62. So I think you have to be very careful when how many times you actually stand before the team and say, let's get together because I have something to say. These guys are men, not machines. You look for effort first, and then you recognize that sometimes the execution's not going to be there because you just can't be perfect.
What do you tell a player who could have played harder?
Well, that's the one thing that you cannot tolerate. So if you see somebody who shorts you the effort, not only is that person, your relationship with that person affected, but all the other teammates, they're watching. So if somebody gets by with not running a ball out or not getting the job done because they just physically didn't give you the effort, if you turn the other, you know, turn your cheek or ignore it, it's going to have an effect on the player and the whole team. So in effort, now, when it comes to effort, I usually treat that right now. I'll do it right during the game. I'll mention it. If for some reason something is distracting immediately after the game, usually in the privacy of my office, but if I think it's important enough, I think you have to confront a player right in the clubhouse.
In front of other players?
In front of other players. But that's a drastic one. I think if you nail a guy coming off the field in front of everybody in the dugout, it's got to be something severe.
Let me ask you about a few things very briefly. When you're in some kind of dispute or trying to discipline a player who's very high paid and getting paid a lot more money than you are, does it make it hard for you to have the kind of power and authority that you want in that situation?
Good question, and I think one that's very much misunderstood. The answer is absolutely not.
Uh-huh.
Number one, I never talk to the player about money. Therefore, it's not an issue. I don't care if the guy's making $1 million, $2 million, or he's a rookie making 60. Never talk to him. The issue or whatever the problem is has to do with something on the field. So the relative salary between us has nothing to do with it. Second, I think I've learned, you are the manager. You are a man in authority. And if you are willing to take the authority and exert it, you will be paid the proper due. So, no, I don't think the salary difference has anything to do with it.
There's an old saying in baseball about how, you know what I'm going to say here, that the best managers are, mediocre players usually make really good managers. And you were a mediocre player when you were.
That's the kindest thing to say. I was worse than mediocre.
Well, I think your batting average was 200 for.
You just gave me 2 points, about 198.
198, okay. So is there truth in that, do you think?
I think there's some truth in it, and I'm not making any claim about what I am as a manager, but I think there's no doubt in my mind that if you're a scuffling type player that had to survive, in your scuffles, you would have had to learn a lot of the pieces of the game and play them to your max amount. Sometimes if you're a better player, you know, if you're an outstanding hitter or something, or an outstanding pitcher, then you can just do your strength so well that pieces of it are not that necessary unless you personally make it a point to be a complete player. That, to me, is the formula. So if you see a player who does it all and really loves the game, well, just being a star doesn't mean he's not going to be a good manager. If you're not a good player to survive. You're forced to learn a lot about the game, and then when you get into it, I think number one, you have those lessons, but number two, I think you do have, and here's probably the key call, Terry, I think you have a certain appreciation of the different ranks of players. You know, I really believe that I understand what a guy who's struggling as a young player is trying to do, a bench player, a veteran player just coming off the peak of his years. So I'm not sure sometimes the star gets that appreciation unless he really is people interested.
Mm-hmm. Is it true that you were signed the night that you graduated from high school? Must have been some night.
Yes, it was. It was, you know, an exciting time for a young player back then because there was no draft. So it was back when anybody who was interested could court you. And at those days, there was 24 major league teams, and I had 20 contract offers of the 20. It was only four teams that did not express an interest. So it was, you know, you had people coming in, they'd take you to dinner. They would, you know, Charlie Finley personally flew down from Chicago to meet our family. So it was a very exciting, and it was, you know, you thought, wow, if 20 clubs are interested, I must have some ability. And the fact was, graduation night, when we came back to my parents' home, there were three scouts' cars parked outside waiting to talk to me about which club to go with.
Was it disappointing for you to have been courted the way you were and to be given so much money to sign with the A's and then to not fulfill that promise? Did you feel like a failure when you were starting in baseball?
My answer is no. I'll tell you why. It ended up being adversity that you grow with. You know, I don't talk about it much, but if push came to shove, if I had stayed healthy, I think I would have been a pretty good player. Mm-hmm. You know, I hurt my arm, I hurt my back, you know, it goes on and on and on. So what I learned about myself was that I wasn't a quitter, that I could play with pain, and that it meant enough to me to start something and finish something. So later on, as I started getting healthier, I ended up having some pretty decent years, especially in AAA. But I was then, I wouldn't say a fraction of what, but I couldn't throw very well anymore. You know, my mobility was cut back. But I still played for 15 years. So when I quit, I knew that although my talents had been limited, I knew that I had some internal strength, that, you know, that I could deal with pain, and I wasn't a quitter.
We talk about pain and injuries. I think it was in 1963, the year that you were first signed. You injured your shoulder or a tendon while playing, and you didn't tell anybody, so you went through spring training without reporting the injury. And did you do permanent? Well, why didn't you tell anybody, first of all?
Well, I had a chance to make the major league team. It was, you know, one of those bonus baby provisions where if they want to keep you, they can choose to keep you on the big league team, and I knew I was one of the guys being considered, so I felt like I could fake it, and, you know, the more that I threw with it, finally it ended up tearing. I had a tendon problem in my throwing shoulder, right arm, ended up tearing. But that was, you know, I was just trying to survive at that point, and, you know, just not smart enough to realize, you know, if I hurt my throwing arm as an infielder, it's not going to be very good for my career down the road. But, you know, I never said I was smart.
You were one of only five managers in the history of baseball who also have had law degrees. When did you get yours?
Well, at the end of this mediocre playing career, you know, it was when it became obvious to me that I wasn't going to be a good major leaguer and make enough money to sustain my family, I got to do something else. And you know, I loved to read. I liked solving problems, and I had friends who were lawyers. So I started going to law school during the off season, surely figuring that I was going to finish playing ball any one of these years, finish my law degree, become a lawyer. So I started in 73. And went every winter. It took me five winters. But what happened was, about the end of the 76 season, the managing bug kind of bit me. So I tried to manage, and everything, I'm telling you, if I talk to you about my first few years managing, everything fell into place. I got to the big leagues very quickly, and therefore law became something that got shoved aside. But at one point, I was going to be a lawyer as soon as my playing career was over. But the managing thing, I just caught every break in the world.
Anything about law come in handy for you as a manager?
I think so. I think the attention to detail and the preparation that they teach you in school will give you an edge in a case. I'm convinced, I've become convinced in my own mind, that if I come into a series against a team, if I'm prepared in my own case down to the last detail, if the team is prepared, we'll have our best chance to win. So I think that's one carryover.
Let's talk about arguing with umpires. When you do argue with an umpire, does your legal background ever come in handy?
Nah. Nothing comes in handy when you work with umpires.
Right.
There's nothing going to help. Early on, they would kid me about it a little bit. Because, you know, I had played for a long time in my league, so a lot of these men I knew. It was more a matter of kidding. But I got to say, basically, you go out there, if you have a legitimate argument, you say it quickly and you get out, because you're not going to change anybody's mind.
Let me ask you to remember one of your baseball memories from childhood, one of the things that really hooked you on the game.
Most of them, I have three or four that come to mind real quickly. One, they used to have something called the Intersocial League, which is a semi-pro league, played on Thursday night and Sunday afternoon. And a real plum was being the scoreboard keeper. So, you know, they had a manual scoreboard in center field, and you sat in a wheelbarrow between the balls and the strikes. And because it was obvious that I loved the game when I was very young, they gave me that job. And you used to get, I believe it was $3 on Thursday night and $5 for the Sunday doubleheader. So one of my best memories was just sitting there in center field, you know, being the, you know, ball strike, get up and put the outs and put the score up and get to watch this game on Thursday night and the doubleheader on Sunday. And then if it was a weekday, another memory that I have was, you know, we lived upstairs above a service station. And there was an alley, and my mom, because my dad worked all the time, my mom would play catch with me in the alley. That's when I was real young. And you remember those things, and, you know, and that's some of my strongest memories.
Tony La Russa, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about baseball in your life. Thank you.
Okay, Terry, thank you for having me.
Oakland A's manager Tony La Russa. This is Fresh Air. What's coming up on All Things Considered, Robert Siegel?
Well, we'll be hearing from Richard Harris in San Francisco about the Tenderloin District, one of the neighborhoods hard hit by the earthquake, and we'll find out what it might mean to residents there if the region is rebuilt and perhaps if they're priced out of the place where they live. From New York City, we have a couple of stories. The mayoral race, you know, is underway. It's getting pretty heavy. And the reports are that many Jewish voters in New York City, those who are more politically conservative, are jumping ship from the Democrat David Dinkins in favor of Republican Rudolph Giuliani. That's an interesting one. And also a story about an anniversary of the New York City subway system and what New Yorkers are doing to celebrate.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In this age of glasnost, Billy Joel, Bon Jovi, and Pepsi have all made appearances in the Soviet Union. And now, Billy Crystal. Critic at Large Laurie Stone has a review of Crystal's work and his new HBO special, Midnight Train to Moscow.
Меня зовут Билли Кристал. Я американский комик. Я первый американский комик в Москве.
Billy Crystal loves vulgarity. He adores playing people who flaunt their appetites, their need for attention, their prurient curiosity, people like Sammy Davis Jr., Fernando Lamas, and Tina Turner. Crystal's impressions are psychological character studies, not only of individuals, but of the impulses they embody. There is little meanness in him, because he's not judging. His attitude is the opposite of Woody Allen's. Allen shows you his hectoring Jewish clan and wants you to think, look how far he's come from his crude origins. Crystal plays his kinfolk, who belch after each sentence and complain incessantly, and he wants you to appreciate their classic clowning and directness.
I'd been to Russia in 1987 with a B'nai B'rith group from Boca Raton. Bill's uncle Leonard and I went there on a trip. It was a horror. Take toilet paper and plenty of it. Leonard said, why don't I just drop my pants and rub my hiney on a curb for about 2 weeks? He had the ass of a baboon. It was disgusting. Speaking of disgusting, don't try the food. I made that mistake, and my head was in the bottom of a toilet for 2 weeks. I didn't see anything. I absolutely hated the trip. But the people are wonderful, and I'm a people person.
But Crystal has another side. He can be sentimental, and he can be smug, wishing to call attention to his own fine instincts. A black jazz musician he plays is called Lester Hawkins. He's all softness and mild irony and has no leaking appetites and urges. As Hawkins, Crystal wants you to think what a wonderful guy he is for respecting black culture. Both sides of Crystal ride through his HBO comedy special, Midnight Train to Moscow, although the witty, silly Crystal is mostly in control, and some of the laughs he inspires are gut-splitting. He wants to take advantage of glasnost openness and also discover his Russian roots, so he plays a comedy concert in Moscow. The concert itself is tame. Too many of the bits are predictable pantomimes. But the film soars when Crystal lets his imagination fly and visits Moscow locations. His sweetness shows in a reunion dinner he shares with 20 long-lost cousins, and his satiric bite and love of vulgarity rear up in set pieces all along the way. In one, an old man with gnarled fingers argues heatedly in Russian, and Crystal responds unexpectedly.
No. The cop grabbed Zsa-Zsa, and then she hit him. Zsa-Zsa just didn't hit him.
И Горбачев, и Буш все. Они делали все, чтобы был мир. Мир был у нас.
No, it's right. They're on Rodeo Drive. The cop pulled her over. He got fresh with her, and Zsa-Zsa then hit him. That's what she said.
Я вас, обождите, я вас, ну, я понимаю, что вы тоже за мир, правильно или нет?
No, that's Ava.
And in the pièce de résistance, Crystal conjures a scene in which Gorbachev listens to Barry Pettelman, an American movie producer, offer suggestions about how Russia can change. At one point, Pettelman's cellular phone rings and he takes a call from his wife.
Oh, hi, honey. No, I'm not in a car. I'm in Moscow with Gorbachev. Yeah, listen, very quickly, a couple of things. Yeah, did Mrs. Gandhi call? Yeah, well, she wants a lake of seats. Yeah, we'll give her, you know, yeah, like for a Miami game or something. And you go with her and you tell the hot dog guy whatever she wants is fine. Oh, and call Cy Spaulding. The guy did my plugs? Yeah. No, I'm on the plane. We hit an air pocket and we lost pressure in the cabin. Yeah, I popped 18 plugs right out of my forehead. Yeah, sound like the goddamn 4th of July, you know?
When Crystal dives wholeheartedly into bad taste, he saves himself and us from his own vulgar self-satisfaction.
Lori Stone is a New York-based writer and critic. Our interviews are produced by Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers. Naomi Person produces our reviews. They're edited and mixed by Joan Tui, Penny Hain, and Karen Impala. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, singer Mavis Staples tells us about performing music sacred and profane with her family, the Staple Singers, and more recently with Prince. Also, writer Marita Golden on her latest novel, the story of three generations of an African-American family in Washington, D.C. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.